So this is a conversational keynote. We're just having a conversation. It's like
Yeah.
you and me, hanging out at a bar. Except no drinks. What's wrong with that picture? For those of you who weren't here earlier, Ben did a wonderful introduction and talked a little bit about his work at Walt Disney Studios. But we're going to shift gears. We were talking a little bit about information security earlier, enculturation, BYOD, ransomware. It was a broad topic of digital-based topic, should we say. But we're going to move into this third-party auditing vendor ecosystem and talk specifically about how content holders and creators can work to kind of secure their village, to borrow Mr. Stahl's language. Thankfully, you've prepared a wonderful deck for us. And I have a clicker right here. If you'll cue up that. Let's start before we jump right into this. And how long have you been at Disney, and has this been your primary focus?
Content security. So I've been at Disney for 6 years. At the time that Disney were acquiring Marvel, they decided they wanted to beef up their proactive content security programs. So historically, it was very much a compliance program. They relied very heavily on the audits that were conducted by the MPA. Marvel pre-acquisition and post-acquisition had a very, very content security-centric mindset. And they were looking for Disney to kind of take that and run with it. So we set about, when I joined the company, we set about building out these content security services. So the deck that we're going to run through today, we've got quite a few slides. So if slides are of interest, then ask questions. If they're not, we'll take that as a sign that the topic is maybe
We're saying yes.
not hidden.
Just
hidden
blurt
there,
out
right?
next. Just say next.
Thumbs up, thumbs down.
All right. We're talking about also, you have thousands of vendors at Disney.
Yeah.
Right?
We have, at the moment, we have 2,200 approved vendors for theatrical pre-release theatrical content, and we, as I mentioned, I kind of touched on it earlier. We have this tiered framework. Not every vendor needs to be, locked down to the same degree as some of our others, and we have a very, very big set of security requirements and controls. So the ability to scope and filter those security requirements contextual to the work that a particular vendor is performing is critical, both in terms of fairness on the third party, but also for us to be able to manage our costs associated with our content security programs.
And before we dig into this, obviously this is very studio-centric, so very motion picture theatrical
Yes.
centric. But part of your purview is expanding. This is something also that is very applicable to broadcast.
Yes, I can't speak too authoritatively relating to broadcast workflows. It's an area that's relatively new in terms of our responsibilities. But yes, there is certainly a lot of overlap, and we're going to be defining distinctions within the framework for broadcast TV over the coming months.
Okay, and if you have a question while we're going through any of this, please raise your hand. We'll get them. We haven't even started. What could your question possibly be? Get this man a microphone.
No, it's okay. I can talk.
Oh, here, I want you on tape.
What is
Here.
The dollar amount, percentage that you are trying to ascribe now to security that you didn't have to do before? Are you saying 5% of the budget or 1% of the budget
Ooh,
should be dedicated to security? In any SLA or any document, there must be a security component.
We don't, just because of the way that I mentioned earlier that we carry all the costs centrally for our security services. And we do a blended recharge back. So the productions ultimately pay one-fifth or one-sixth of the cost of the program, but we don't have a fixed percentage mapping.
That's the enterprise level.
It's done at the enterprise level. Yeah, in terms of enterprise as in the Walt Disney Studios family and DATG, our Disney ABC Television Group. We cover those costs centrally and then bill back a blended rate. So
inside those documents, you can see you have something written and everything that requires that reverts back to that cost.
Yes.
Yeah.
Excellent. All right, so holding third-party vendors accountable.
Yes. I think we can skip through the gray slides because they're just kind of setting the tone for each section.
All right. That's a good read, though.
Okay. So having a set of content security programs that are ever adapting and fast-paced is kind of critically important. We touched on a few notes this morning at a high level in terms of the convergence between content security and information security and the importance of having technologists as part of the content security programs. Not that many years ago on the theatrical content security side, we were protecting 35 mil reels and we were protecting set pieces and props, whereas now 99% of our protection measures relate to digital content traversing, pre-production, on-set production, all of the post and distribution channels. So we need to, from one perspective, to make sure that our executives are funding our programs appropriately, we need to make sure that they understand what the real-world threats are to our content, and that we have corresponding controls and measures in place. I forget now which stories we pulled out.
You got the Netflix hack, you got the ransomware.
So being able to provide assurances to our stakeholders that we have corresponding programs in place. From a ransomware perspective, it's the way that we encrypt assets, the way that we handle ingest of content, the way that we segregate our networks, both internally and with our third-party partners. The Disney content that was exposed as part of the Larson Studios hack, and I can speak more openly about it now because there's been a lot of stories in the press relating to the Larson Studios hack and Larson Studios themselves.
Orange is the New Black hack, hack as well, yeah. So that you don't know.
The hacker group was TDO, the Dark Overlord, and they've received a great deal of press because of the media content that they extorted. But they've actually been running a extortion business for quite some time. There is information out that's been publicly disclosed now. They're making an average of $150,000 a week extorting content from small businesses, demanding a ransom, and then releasing those assets back if the ransom is paid. So,
and to be fair, that's across healthcare and... Right, I mean, it's not just in media and entertainment, that $150,000. And correct me if I'm wrong.
Dental surgeries, plastic surgeons, schools, charitable organizations. Yeah, they're not picky on the victims that they extort from.
It's important to note that very little of it is from our industry.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you, Al.
The level of effort required by the hackers is low. The level of effort required from the content owner perspective to protect assets throughout the pipelines is high. Certainly some of the measures that we've taken to protect our vendor community have paid dividends. In this instance, from this instance, Larson Studios had not been, we were not, from a content security perspective, we were not aware that they were handling pre-release assets. As a result of that, they had not been through a security review. We're not compliant with the security requirements. So this has become a good case study for us about the importance in our training and awareness programs, making sure that teams within the theatrical and TV workflows understand that there are services available to them. So it goes back to those points that I was focusing on earlier about the importance of making sure that the people handling content understand the security services that are available to them and don't feel that that's introducing bureaucracy and red tape and slowing them down, that they actually feel confident that the services are agile.
Well, it's interesting too. They're so brash and so brazen, but they're also looking for that bit of fame as well. It's not, look, it's financially driven, but it's also, the Dark Overlord is obviously driven by ego.
Interesting. That does seem to be the case.
Interesting.
So this is an eye chart, and this isn't meant for you guys to read the text on this line. It's just we just wanted to show an example of how we record information from previous incidents and use this type of format to educate our stakeholders. So I think I mentioned this earlier. We have these various different groups of communities, making sure that they understand kind of the anatomy of the incident that occurred and how that relates to them. We feel that's important. So this is just one example of some of the stakeholder materials that we generate.
And you've really built a kind of a supply chain for content protection, right? I mean, ultimately, right? Where it begins and it ends.
Yep.
All right, I'm supposed to walk through the gray slides. I mean, look, ultimately, I think we all know that this is not a problem that is shrinking. It's a problem that's growing. And I think you mentioned this earlier about the top-down approach as well as the bottom-up approach. And I think another important piece is the audit piece, which if those of you aren't aware, we go out and visit facilities, whether it's Disney or CDSA or other studios through the MPAA. You know, this tends to be more and more of a collaborative effort as we keep moving forward in time, simply because we're all protecting essentially the same thing.
Okay, so this is these are the three groups that I was referring to. So the way that we've chosen to tackle our kind of community management, our socialization of policies and procedures, is by grouping our stakeholders into three buckets. On the right-hand side of the slide, our steering committees, we have many steering committees. We spin those, they're very fluid. We spin them up, and we spin them down as necessary when we're forming new programs, when we're looking for funding. Then we have our content security councils, one on the studio side, one that we're just spinning up on the media, on the DATG side. These are our executive stakeholders with the organizational and geographic spread so that we have representation across the business. And this serves multiple purposes. Obviously, we need the executive staff within the business to understand why we do the things that we do. Why there may be some additional waypoints in their workflows in order to accommodate the security requirements that we put upon them. And as I said earlier, just supporting the endeavors from an executive stakeholder perspective. And then lastly, the top left-hand side, what we refer to as our content guardians, our advocates. When we go out and understand how our business unit operates, and we identify individuals that have distinct responsibilities relating to creating sensitive information, creating content, handling that sensitive information, distributing that information, we essentially deputize them into our program. They receive quarterly training objectives. We contribute to their annual performance reviews. And we give them an opportunity to feel vested in the security requirements that they are going to enforce within their teams and with their third-party relationships.
Are the guardians all Disney employees, or does it branch out outside of that, or is there a plan there?
There is a plan there. So currently they're all Disney employees. We are planning on having a sister program to the internal employee content guardians program, where we identify key points of contact within our third-party partners, and also kind of bring them into this advocates fold. So we give them training, and then request that they socialize that information within their teams. We find that that's a far more effective way. If people hear positions on security policies from a trusted member of their group, rather than going to a website or reading a 20-page policy document, which very rarely happens in our experience. So it's a technique that works well in terms of achieving that hearts and minds element of our program.
Excellent.
Okay, so just a quick run through the way that we think about content security at Disney. Content workflow assessments is the beginning of our process. We sit down, we interview the teams. We really make sure that everything we do comes from a position of understanding. So I think one of the slides we're going to look at in a minute shows the material, one of the materials we generate. But we go out, wherever they're physically located, we'll sit down and interview the teams and make sure that we understand the nuances of their operations. And then we'll do the gap analysis with our existing policies and procedures. If there isn't a good match, or if they need more prescriptive guidance, we'll generate materials that are directly in line with the work that business unit or that team is performing. If those policies map well and we already have a kind of a corresponding right way of doing the thing that team needs to do, then we'll get into the training and awareness realm, and we'll make sure that we have materials that are accessible, that whether that means local language, whether it the materials are tailored to the work that that team is performing, and then we'll choose a format that works well. So we do quite a few kind of animated training courses, kind of in-flight safety video style, short, slightly humorous. And we track, that way we have ability to track who's taken the course when, whether they acknowledge that they understood what was expected of them, and make sure that's persistent. So it's not just training that's delivered at the point of hire. So if somebody joins a company, they take their security induction training, and they're with a company for the next 20 years, and obviously that information is out of date. We make sure that our employees and our third-party partners take some form of content security training at least every 12 months. Okay, so I'm going to jump ahead a little bit here. So from the previous slide, you probably saw the section that was highlighted was our third-party, our site security audits and our app and cloud. That's where most of the money that we spend currently is in the actual executing the audits. We go on site to all of our third-party partners and perform the risk assessment. We go on site with some of our application and cloud platform providers. We do code review, pen test. We maintain that assessment at least annually, and with our application providers every 3 months. So on this slide, we're actually looking at, we've fallen into a situation where a lot of other companies will ask a vendor or a service provider of some sort, are you approved to receive Disney content? And if the answer is yes, then they'll take that at face value and they'll go ahead and use that vendor without performing any of their own security reviews. So because of the level of investment that we elected to put into this, we inadvertently ended up kind of bankrolling some of the security activities within the industry. And that doesn't really serve anybody well. So the decision that we have made and been trying to push for within the industry is a better set of centralized audit services. So if you think of the payment card industry, the way that the PCI DSS program was stood up, the way that the PCI DSS program accredits auditors, manages central assessment services, our intent is, in partnership with the CDSA and the MPA and the content owners represented in this room, is to have our third-party partners subject to one rigorous annual audit, and then all of the content owners have access to that. So another analogy is maybe Angie's List. If you're looking for a plumber to repair a leaky faucet, you want some degree of confidence that individual is reputable and ethical. And that's how we would like to steer the audit services for the industry, a single central repository that gives content owners a degree of confidence that partner is complying with a predetermined framework of security requirements. Now, what we're not saying from that is that the content owner shouldn't do their own workflow-related review. What it does mean is they should feel with confidence that a post-production house has the right network segregation in place, the right firewall configuration, the right management controls in place, and so forth. They don't need to worry about those baseline security requirements. They still should verify that their content handling procedures are appropriate for that particular show or any other creative content they want to put through those workflows. And that's what, in our mind, would constitute in this scenario an approval.
Question for the audience, when do you think this all might happen?
Am I premature in speaking?
Probably.
Yeah, this, okay, so I'll be completely...
Considering our board meetings tomorrow.
Our intention is to publicly announce the program at the Content Protection Summit in December. It's kind of a little bit like the Tesla Model 3, with just little bits of information here and there, keeping people excited for the grand reveal in December. But we're doing a lot of work behind the scenes to make sure that all of logistical elements, all the governance responsibilities, all of the security requirements, all the tools that are required to run a program like this, and all of the shared responsibilities between the two, between the MPA and the CDSA are all in place, but confident that things are progressing well at this point.
Well, and also taking into account, there's many moving pieces, many moving parts to this. Not that the studios have been protective, but at the same time, they've been very conscious about the vendors that they use and not sharing inappropriate information with other studios, right? Because ultimately, that could get everybody into a lot of trouble. Oh, this guy's a good guy, that guy's a bad guy. It's not meant to be that. This is meant to be a rolling system where we share the information that we can share. And it could just be something as simple as an audit date. But I think there's many pieces to that model that do need to be discussed. So expect a comprehensive update in December.
One of the other challenges that we're facing here, and I know that, Al, this is something that you share with us, is that we have vendors that are exhausted by the fact that they're being audited multiple times in a year. Slightly, each of the content owners have slightly different security requirements. So it's expensive for us. It's expensive for the vendor, for our partners, and that's both on the application security, the cloud platform assessment, and the industry vendor community.
Excellent. Standard spotty, presided. All right, we're just staying on track. All right, so what are some of the organizational challenges?
Yeah, I feel like we've covered some of this. I don't know whether we need to dwell on this slide and the next slide.
I'm obviously doing everything up here. Can I butter your bagel at the break? Yeah. I'll be dishing out macaroni and cheese for lunch. Okay.
I feel like this is just lists out some of the challenges that we've just been referring to. There's vendors that undergo lots of audits that touch on different points. Content owners that have slightly different emphasis.
Can you talk about the overlap in security services? Ultimately, just in terms of explaining what you're meaning, right? Because gaps in coverage is easy to understand. So security services overlaps, what are we really talking about then?
This may well be unique to Disney. I don't know. Disney's a 180,000 employee company, some very, very large segments. There isn't just one security group. There are lots of different security groups. Some of them overlap, whether it's the physical on-set security teams, whether it's our enterprise information security teams, whether it's our segment-specific information security teams, content security teams, the list goes on and on and on and on. It is a challenge, but the executive stakeholder briefings, the content security council sessions that I spoke about, making sure that there was a very strong brand for the work that we do, and a very, very clear kind of delineation of responsibilities. It's something that we're still kind of working on, but making sure that we're completely transparent.
Well, and it's almost like baseline vendor, baseline internal, right? I mean, you've got to get all your bases covered and get everybody aligned under the same.
Yeah. And again, I feel like we've probably
a little more redundant.
Yep. Okay, so as I said, the big, big push for us at the moment is I think we have, knock on wood, for the most part, we have a pretty well thought out set of security services on the back end. The way that we educate our end users, the way that we educate our third party partner employees, not relying on NDAs, because people don't read NDAs, relying too extensively on language in contracts, because only the lawyers read those. How do we extend expectation setting out to the third-party employees that actually handle our assets? Because that invariably is where most of our issues occur. And again, this is cropped up in a number of the discussions so far today. The assets may well be extensively protected. The one thing that we can't protect against is somebody taking a picture of an asset with their cell phone, or going onto a blog, or going on some internet social media platform and sharing information about what they've observed. We're making some inroads. This is still a problem for us, but we at least are now investing what we feel appropriately in in all of the training and awareness elements of our program. That's really where the heavy push is at the moment.
Have you seen a shift in employee attitude since you started? I mean, obviously, you know, going off in a million different directions and depending upon who was the head of what unit, and, you know, I mean, have you seen some noticeable change in terms of the, I mean, it's obviously hard across 180,000 employees, et cetera, but is this something you feel is palpable?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what we're ultimately talking about here is cultural change. You know, how do you start to get people to think differently, intuitively, subconsciously about the way that they handle certain pieces of information? So I mentioned earlier the concept of kind of the brand of the content security programs. What differentiates that set of services from the other information security programs? I'm trying to think of some good examples now of where we see change. I mean, having vendors approach us when they see a business unit transferring an asset incorrectly, having teams reach out to us because they want to participate in the development of security policies, because historically maybe they either didn't understand the policies or they just felt that it didn't apply to them, or there was no reasonable way for them to apply to policies, but there was no way for them to contribute to the development of those security requirements, whereas now they're approaching us and saying, we'd like to make sure that we at least do a review and have the opportunity to contribute, because we've never been able to comply with this thing and we've never told anybody. But now that they have a voice, they have a community within which they can share their challenges and feel vested in the development of those requirements.
Large feedback loop, that's great.
Okay, so another thing that we've invested extensively on is the tool set automation. Even if we're fortunate to get more money, and in some cases get more headcount, which is extremely difficult to secure, we're constantly looking at how do we manage the data that we collect? How do we manage the workflows relating to content security? How much can we automate? How many processes can we take the human out of at least a part of the equation? And there are a number of great GRC tools out there, off-the-shelf products. For a number of different reasons, we made a decision to build our own. And these are the main, I don't know how much, I forget now how much we go into detail in this in the following slides, but we broke out the following main interfaces for the tool. So we've got the back-end GRC tool, we've got a managed workflow for the way that the auditor performs their assessment when they're on site with a third party. We want to, as we increase the number of auditors, we wanted to ensure that there was consistency in the way that the auditor was measuring compliance with the third party. We didn't ever want there to be too much discretion or for one third party to be subject to a more rigorous assessment than another just because it was a different auditor that was walking through the front door. Taking things out off of email. We handle a lot of sensitive information when we're performing these risk assessments. So it was important to us to make sure that we had a complete end-to-end workflow management tool where everything was driven through the tool. Multi-factor authenticated, we live and breathe our own requirements in terms of the configuration of the infrastructure. So having our third-party partners log into a portal where they receive their tasks, manage their pre-audit information gathering, they would manage their remediation and any other advisories that they may receive over the course of the year. And then vendor roster, which I think we cover on the next slide.
Okay, next slide.
No, we don't, but it's coming up soon. Vendor roster is basically that Angie's List analogy that I used earlier. Making the database of approved systems and vendors as intuitive to use as possible. So we basically have a portal that any business units across Disney go to, and is Joe's VFX house approved to receive this type of content? Is this application approved to transfer my media? Okay. Yes. Yeah. Okay. So the framework, on the back end, we use the same standard ISO asset classification schema from public through to company confidential. For the creative workflows, that terminology didn't resonate well with the creative teams. They were looking for basically a high, medium, low. Just, you know, this show falls into this category for whatever reason. So we asked that community through the steering committees, through the Security Council, to give us the verbiage they wanted us to use in this framework. And this is ultimately what the steering committees and those groups came up with. Low is tier two. The bulk of our content is tier one. And then the Star Wars assets or some of the Marvel shows fall into this, or any full feature clean content falls into that upper tier. That's really, really close hold information as far as we're concerned. Yep. Okay, now this, again, eye chart, I apologize. Within the GRC tool that we built, for each show that we protect, we generate this asset tier matrix, and it's basically a list of all of the assets that the show is gonna be producing. That's a long list. And then it's all of the production milestones. So what this allows us to do is to plot over the course of the production from green light through to theatrical release, through to in-home release, or the whatever the waypoints are in the context of that project, to plot the increasing and decreasing sensitivity of an asset. Assets don't remain flat at one classification. And because this is built into the GRC tool, the tool automates some of the decision making about, if this vendor is receiving this asset at this moment in time, they need to be cleared at the following level. It takes, well, we got into a situation, one of the things that drove us to build out this component was business units coming to us dictating what the clearance level for the vendor needed to be. This vendor needs to be cleared at tier one. This vendor needs to be cleared at tier two. And there's a natural bias to that. Maybe they're choosing a lower classification just because they want to use the vendor more quickly, or an abundance of caution, and they're suggesting that we overly invest in locking down a facility. So this takes the guesswork out of that. So the tool, in terms of automation, once we've gone through the pre-audit phase and we've gone on site, we've performed the risk assessment, we've generated a report with the remediation task, the vendors closed out those remediation items, we verified that the remediation is effective and they received their approval. Then they move into maintenance mode. So basically every quarter, the vendor will be asked to confirm that they're still at the same location, still providing the same services, the same employees that were listed as handling client content, still the same group of people, and that the infrastructure and the tools that they're using are still the same. And that the system handles that every 3 months. This is a view within Vendorosta. So this is what our business units see when they go in and check whether a partner is approved, see what their clearance level is, what services they're cleared to provide, where they're located, who the points of contact are.
Oh, you got a building there. Look at you, schmancy. All right. Okay.
And this is the workflow-driven auditor tool.
So they're not auditing them on paper. They're actually in a device.
Yeah. So the auditor sees all of the in-scope controls. They see all of the questionnaire responses relating to that control. They can see the actual control that they're seeking compliance with. And they can make record their observations, and if appropriate, record a remediation task while they are on site performing the risk assessment. The tool presents them at the end of the assessment with their exit interview summary and the list of observations and non-conformities.
All right, more gray chart.
Yes.
So obviously, look, this is no easy task. It's not super sexy and exciting to look at a GRC tool, like, I'll be honest with you, right? But the output on this, when you get everybody on the same page and the ability to access this data, is obviously critical.
Yeah, I think what we're trying to kind of touch on here is that it's not just about subjecting third-party partners to an audit. You really need to understand the workflow context. You need to truly understand the sensitivity of the assets that are being shared. You need to take the burden of responsibility to make sure that that you're asking vendors to be compliant with security restrictions for a reason. Then it's not just a compliance check. It is actually a risk assessment that is cognizant of the work that they're going to be performing.
Well, accountable.
Yeah.
Ultimately. Anticipating LOE lead time.
Yeah, no need to dwell on this one. Just we make sure that our business units understand the lead time. So coming to us on a Monday wanting to do business with a third party where they could be disclosing intellectual property or sensitive company information, there is a certain amount of work that needs to be performed, and we can't turn that around on a dime. So making sure that this information is socialized and they understand the cost impact, even if they're not being asked to submit a cost center or a PO number, we're covering that cost on the back end, but they need to understand that there is a lot of work that goes into securing these environments. Now, he's talking about dull slides.
How are we doing next? No, sorry, that was a little joke.
I will just touch on this one just for a second, because there is something important to be kind of gleaned from this slide. The relationship between the published best practices for the industry, and again, I've chosen MPA here, but for whatever, for your respective industries, having a set of security requirements that are tailored to services. So the master control might be, don't distribute intellectual property assets unencrypted, or they must be stored encrypted at rest. But how does that, how do you actually measure that in a visual effects environment? How do you measure that in a DCP replicator environment, or whatever the respective workflows might be? And having everything codified so that you can measure specifically, and you're not relying on too much auditor discretion when it comes to determining whether or not a workflow or a facility is compliant. And this slide, just in terms of level of effort, so this is for one of our programs, just to give you an indication about the amount of work that goes into a content security program, some of the key metrics. And we try and use a balance of analytics and metrics for our stakeholders just so they get a sense of the work that's going on behind the scenes, so that when we do need to come back and ask for headcount, or we do need to come back for more funding, they understand, have a little bit of a kind of familiarity with exactly what we're doing. So for the first two quarters of our content security program, these are just some key stats. Now, vendor employees trained, I think that's an important one. I mentioned that we deploy automated training. It's a 6-minute animated training course. We deliver it in 14 different languages, subtitled and dubbed. That means any employee of any third party that handles Disney Studios intellectual property, or our ABC Television Group intellectual property, those employees have to go through this mandatory training course.
We have 5 minutes. I think we have 5 minutes left, if I'm not mistaken. And maybe 6 if we really push it. Do we want to take some questions? Is there another piece of the slides that you want to hit real quick?
I can't remember what slides come next.
There's only one more slide? All right.
All right.
Man, we did perfect.
Oh.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Chart.
There it is. More gears. No. This is important, and this is also explaining some of what will be to come in December and how this is all going to integrate around the tool. Let's take a question from the audience, ladies and gentlemen. Does anybody have a question for Mr. Stanbury before we wrap this up? I think, look, the other thing that I was going to ask you is, you're sitting here and you're like, you're Disney, you're ginormous. What does the little guy do? Say it's a business unit that's leading the charge in a larger organization, or just saying, hey, we really need to get this together, or a smaller content creator. Some of these content creators are getting very boutique. So, any pieces of advice around that, of where do you start?
I think just knowing that you're not alone, that there are a lot of companies are out there solving problems, so it's more important than ever to not think about security necessarily as a proprietary function. The reason that I'm here today is that I rely very heavily on a number of different communities, one of them being the CDSA. There's a reason why I dedicate a good chunk of my time to meeting with my peers. Just don't feel that that you need to solve a lot of the challenges alone. There are lots of companies out there, a lot of other security teams that are willing to share a lot of information. I have been a beneficiary of that. So I would like to kind of return, pay it forward. I will make myself available to anybody in the room if you'd like to talk about with me about any of the services that we've discussed today.
I think it's also important to note that, you know, as CDSA, we've always, so our content protection program has been around since the mid-90s, but it evolved and really since the mid-2000s. But giving people a place to go that may not necessarily be an MPA member studio, I think that's been important. And also building the community around it, where the vendors also feel comfortable engaging and not, it's not just a hard sell on the technology, you really want to get to know them in terms of their passion for their, not only their product, obviously, because they're getting paid, but also for elevating the security in the industry. We've always been a go-to. The other thing that CDSA has done is also it allows the vendors to pay for the audit and own that audit and be able to do with what they want with the audit. But this is also something that we're moving towards in the collaborative model in the future as well. But there's a resource. Chris Johnson was up here earlier on a panel talking about production and post-production security. But I think that's the other piece of why CDSA is in business and what we've been doing for at least the last good solid 10 years. Any questions? Oh, we got one over here in the corner. Hold on, wait for the microphone, please, so you're live on this VOD.
Way over here. Hi, I'm Bruce Roth from IBM CleverSafe, and we have a fundamental technology. It's a storage technology. So do you have any advice? Do you have any advice for a vendor who has a fundamental technology in terms of getting a security audit? Just basically, it would be great to know that the platform has the hooks and, you know, the software, et cetera, to be included in an entire solution that would have a high likelihood of passing the audit.
Yeah, the great thing about, actually, this, so that's perfectly relevant to this slide here. This is the a program, a joint venture between the MPA and the CDSA that we're actively working on at the moment, called the Trusted Partner Network, and it is meant to do exactly that. It's meant to publish security requirements and provide an independent measure of your compliance with industry best practices. And on the the one hand, we're working out all of the nuances of the logistics and mechanics of standing this up, and making sure that the content owners buy into the model that they don't need to do their own independent assessment. So once you've been certified as being complying with that set of security requirements, you're cleared in that first step from that slide in terms of that baseline assessment. So I think this is going to be a great avenue for a company like yourself.
IBM's a member, too, of CDSA, so be sure to talk to me afterwards. Sorry, shameless plug. All right, one last question before we bust this up and get on to our next session. All right, Ben, thank you so much. Thanks for going through that with us. That was enlightening. I appreciate that.